Welcome to the next episode by Literaturnerd.
Randomly, it's the 50th episode, and I have a guest from the USA, Los Angeles, Stephen Markey, who wrote Ohio and the Deluge. This episode is about the Deluge, so we won't talk about anything else because it already has 900 pages, so there's no time to talk about anything else. As the German audience might not know you yet, which will change hopefully, would you like to introduce you, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm Stephen Markley, author of Ohio and the Deluge. I'm also a writer for film and television.
And you appeared in some TV shows in the USA, and you were asked if it's a nice feeling that Stephen King likes your novels.
It's a great feeling. I mean, he was undoubtedly a childhood hero of mine. So the fact that he randomly picked up Ohio and read it and then was gracious enough to read The Deluge next, and he's been a big supporter, and I'm really honored.
And my oldest child is really happy because she's now 9, and you told the audience that you started at 11. So she doesn't have to wait so much longer because she wanted to start now, but I won't allow it. Maybe later. But let's talk about The Deluge. Would you like? I know it's a 900-page novel and we can't summarize it in a couple of minutes, but if you have to summarize it in, like, I don't know how many minutes, what would you tell us?
Yeah, I always say it's a near future epic of the climate crisis. So it starts in 2013. It ends in 2039. It sort of bridges our recognizable past with, you know, the future, or what I think will happen in the future as the climate crisis carries on. And it's very character driven. It's 7 main point of view characters, you know, spanning decades of their lives. And it's sort of about this fight to create a livable future on our planet.
And that's the main point I wanted to talk to you, because I've listened to other interviews, because I thought maybe I don't even have to invite him, or the other people already post that questions, but almost nobody posts questions about the characters. And it's really, you just said it's character driven. Yeah. And I really like character driven prose. Obviously, for most of us, maybe not really for people living in Los Angeles because there are so many fires. But in Germany, at least for most of us, climate crisis is still something abstract. To really feel about it, what it might emotionally mean for us, we need to experience it through authentic figures. So maybe you would lose some words about your main characters.
I populate the book with people who have these different experiences and different perspectives on the crisis. So there's a scientist, an activist, a mathematician, a PR flack working for the fossil fuel lobby, and, you know, an eco-terrorist, and all the way down to a character named Keeper, who's just sort of an impoverished, drug-addicted person in a rural town who doesn't believe in the climate crisis or even think about it. So it's this wide range of human beings all sort of experiencing this same set of events.
I read The Deluge because of a review in The Locus by Ian Mond, and he told the audience, okay, I know it's a big book, but listen, you really have to read that, and it accomplishes something that only really big and thick books can. Yeah. So please read it. And I really trust that reviewer. So I looked, and you can always, with ebooks, you can download a sample. And the first chapter is about Tony, who's a scientist. And I think it's an hour long or something. And the whole chapter was in that sample. And afterwards, I had to buy that book. But of course, then I had to wait, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours to meet Tony again, because there are so many other characters and I really missed him for a long time. But the other characters really do onto me as well, even Keeper, but I think Keeper had the hardest time to grow on me, of course. Sure. I'm really afraid if you would have started that novel with Keeper, I might not have bought the book because yes.
Well, I wouldn't have started the novel with Keeper, so yeah.
So they are really extremely different from each other. Extremely different. So I asked myself, how can you write about them so well? Well, obviously, you can't know from your own experience about these people because they are so different. One is on the spectrum, I think.
Yeah.
It's really well written. It's very convincing. And one is really poor. the keeper, he's really poor, and at least at the beginning, not well. It wasn't easy for me to identify with him. And then you have a mother who's raising her child on her own, and a rich person. So how do you relate with these characters?
Well, I mean, I think for me, the act of writing fiction is always about exploring other lives, walking in other people's shoes, seeing and feeling the world from a perspective other than my own. Like, that is to me the big psychological leap into another person's skin. And it just is for me, like, that's the emotional path to writing a piece of really excellent fiction is the attempt to inhabit somebody else. And as an intellectual exercise, as an emotional exercise, I just find it so challenging and therefore so satisfying. And I think to create a novel of the climate crisis, obviously you need this range of perspectives. You need this effort at seeing the world from other people's points of view. So I always knew the book would have to be this polyphonic, multi-character story.
And you've written it like 12 years long?
Yeah, I started it in 2010 and sort of finished the last edits around 2022. So it definitely was a labor of love and commitment and passion to just stick with the same story for that long.
And I listened in another interview that it used to be even longer, like 600 pages more.
Yeah, the first draft I finished was probably about 600 pages longer, about 1,500 total. And a lot of the editing process was just editing it down, figuring out how to make the story propulsive. You know, I think like if you're asking somebody to pick up a book this big that feels so daunting when you first open it, you know, one of my goals was to make it read quickly and almost feel like a page turner, even though the science is dense, the politics is dense. It's asking a lot of the reader in terms of connecting all these characters and all these different events and aligning the timelines in their minds. But the way you do that is you just make it a page turner.
Which is, it definitely is, even the second or the third time. I listened to the audiobook as well, and it's a great audiobook. I don't think it's easy if you listen to it without having read the book first, but for the second one, it's perfect because it's really well. The speakers are really well chosen. You listen to it as well?
I have not. No, I'm. Even though I understand audiobooks is where a lot of people have migrated. It's to me, the experience of reading a novel is like sacrosanct. I must pick up the book and use my own eyes on it. And yeah, and also with The Deluge. Part of the joy, I think, of reading it is all of what I'm doing with the way the text is presented. There are all these different techniques I'm using in terms of how the layout looks. And that's sort of an integral part of the story. So I always encourage people, like, get that physical copy so you can have, like, the real experience.
I would like to dive into the structure in a minute, but you lost. It used to be 600 pages longer, and you hinted at you had more perspective figures. Now I think you have 6 perspective figures, like a second person, first person, third person. Yeah. But who went away? Who of the side characters used to be a main character?
Oh, I have to be pretty coy about that. It's basically like characters got condensed from 2 people into 1 minor one, or, you know, they simply exited the book gracefully. But yeah, once I had like made those cuts, I had to rewrite around the fact that they were no longer involved. And many of the stories weren't even finished, to tell you the truth. Some of those other point of view characters I cut before I'd even reached halfway through writing it.
It's a page turner. It's really conventional about the thing that I'm really engaged in, and I really want to know what happens next. But structure-wise, you have done some experiments. For example, Keeper is written in the second person perspective. Why Keeper?
Well, I always knew that each voice was going to be distinct, not just in who the person's perspective, but also sort of the way it was presented to the reader. And that way, you know, as you're learning how to read the book, you come across a character and in the first like couple of sentences, you recognize, oh, it's first person. And it's sort of this tone. I'm back with Jackie. Like, I understand who I'm with. And with Keeper, you know, I had the first chapter written from that second person point of view, and it just felt right. It sort of started as more of an instinct than anything else. But I think the second person is like one of those handle with care decisions by an author. Like, if you don't do it well, it's going to come off as really try hard. But, you know, lucky for me, it's like sort of once you get rolling with a character, their voice takes over and it becomes more second nature than you can even imagine. And what that second person with Keeper does is I really think it draws the reader in to a level of complicity and psychological closeness with this person they almost certainly do not identify with naturally, right? And you just sort of, even though you don't want to be strapped into his brain, you find yourself right there next to him for all of these like really terrible things he's up to. And therefore, as his character progresses, you sort of go on that journey with him, you know, and I don't want to give away too much about what that journey is, but, you know, you find yourself compelled to stay beside him.
I think each of the characters does bad and good things. They are ambivalent, all of them. Nobody is good all the time or bad all the time. And that's interesting because that's why I read. I want to the things to be not so black and white, you know. They all have a major development in some points. How do you make that believable for us readers, the development? You already told us you spend really lots of time with them. How do you figure this out, that we go with it and believe you everything?
You know, the magic trick of great fiction writing or writing a great character is that voice becomes second nature to you. I always talk about this idea that like, if you're doing it right, you start out by writing the character yourself and your fingers are moving and you're dictating from your head to the page what they're doing. But at some point you get wrapped up enough in that character and you kind of stop dictating because they're just telling you what's going to happen next. They're sort of rebelling. So like, for instance, I had a character who was supposed to end in this one specific way. And at some point in the novel, I realized, oh, she wouldn't do that. That's not who she is anymore. She's going to do this other thing. And it almost wasn't even my decision. It was her decision. And I know that sounds kind of bonkers. It sounds a little crazy. But I think if you're really doing it right, then you are letting that person take over. And they're almost, you're channeling them more than you're dictating what they're doing. And that's always sort of the trick I look for in when I'm working on a novel or working on a story, is like to just stop doing it the hard way and let that character take over.
I also realized, even with side characters who only have like two or three sentences, for example, there's a chapter in this book where there's a big fire in Los Angeles, and one of the perspective figures runs into a fireman, and the fireman tells him, don't go here, it's a fear fire. Fuck everything and run.
Yeah.
And the fireman maybe has, I don't know, three sentences, but he really sounds like himself.
Yes.
This detail, this love to detail really, really gets me. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Well, how do you learn that? You can't just be born that way, can you?
But this is what I used to tell my students when I taught writing, which is that, like, you know, you always see these blip characters come onto screen when you're watching like a mediocre movie, right? You see them pass through and some actor has to learn that line and they have to put their face on the screen, et cetera, and they walk right through. But that does such a disservice to sort of the distinctiveness every human being has, which is that we all come loaded with our story, with our fears, our anxieties, our hopes, our dreams, et cetera, et cetera. And it just, to me, is like so wonderful when a character just flits by in a story and you're like, wait, oh man, I would follow that person around. I want to hear more about what they're up to. And so I'm always sort of searching for that distinctive voice, even in the smallest of people who populate a story.
So you teach writing as well?
I used to. I'm not doing it right now.
Okay. And you enabled some other guys to write like this as well, in their manner, you know, to write figures like this.
Well, I'm sure none of them listened to me. They were probably, you know, busy texting or looking at TikTok. So, yeah, that's fine, though. I gave them my best advice, and that's all you can do.
Yeah, I guess. So, what a waste. Okay. I really connected emotionally with the characters. Do you have a favorite character, by the way?
I don't know that I have a favorite character, but I certainly, you know, the beating heart of the novel is Kate. I think like the whole book basically is in constellation around her. You know, she is the person that the novel moves through, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's the interesting thing about Kate, which was also mentioned in the review of Ironmont, that she isn't really a perspective figure. So we see her through the eyes of other figures.
Yeah.
So it's like we are getting to know her through her friends, or mostly friends.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
Yes. So with Kate, my idea of her as this, you know, sort of larger than life figure, this activist who has really captured the public imagination, is that we can't ever be inside of her head for too long. Like we, the reader, have to feel this sense of like, oh man, look at this character. Look at her out there. The way we do in real life, the way we sort of access celebrity and access people that we either admire or loathe, right? They're always a little bit of a step removed. And so, you know, my theory of that was, I'm going to tell her story from the point of view of the guy who's had the misfortune of falling in love with her. And we're going to see her from this really intimate perspective and watch as this person gets his heart broken, more or less, by this woman who is ultimately doing something like pretty heroic. And then you see her from all these other angles in the book, and sort of her character changes depending on the person who's looking at her. And I think that creates that effect that I wanted of how we view celebrity and how we view people we don't have access to, but we always feel a closeness with.
Yeah, I can totally relate. Yeah, Kate Morris is very intense. Maybe it would have destroyed her character a little bit to be too close. She's really intense, and people talk to her and she answers and she does things and she does some really cool things and also weird things. Well, it's cool to look at her like this. So I can't really imagine to have her perspective, to read through her eyes. Have you tried that?
So what I did was like, I had Kate's inner monologue in my head, right? Like I knew what she was thinking in all of these scenes, and sort of had it written in the other half of my brain, right? But it's like, then you can't let the reader have access to that. So how do you get hints of it through what the other characters are perceiving? And to me, again, it's like, it's creating this distance that becomes really interesting because, you know, much like Matt, the character who loves her, we so badly want to know what she's thinking. We so badly want to have access to her that we just don't get. And there's a brief flash, without being too spoilery, there's a brief flash when we do, and it's sort of this moment of like, oh man, like this woman has a storm absolutely raging in her head at all times. And that is sort of what motivates her and what fires her. And to me, like that's a really key sort of element of the book is only letting the reader that have that brief glimpse indicate.
So who was first when you started to write? Who appeared first on your private stage in the novel?
Yeah, it was definitely Tony. That first chapter, as I wrote the book and edited it, that first chapter moved around a lot about if it would be first or not. And then finally, I was like, no, this is like where the book has to begin. And I remember one of my friends and fans said to me, you know, I read the first three pages about this scientist, like, just like, thinking about methane hydrates. And I was like, oh my God, Markley has lost his mind. Like he's like gone down a rabbit hole so deep. There's no way this book was going to succeed. But then by the end of the chapter, he was so engrossed with Tony and his life, you know, he had no choice but to keep going. And that's, I think, like what makes that first chapter so interesting is that, you sort of are like, what the hell is going on here? Where are we? Why is this guy the point of view? And then by the end of it, you're like, oh, all right, I'm leaning in, you know?
Well, I never stopped reading. And by the end of the chapter, I bought the book. And I always have too many books to read.
Me too.
So to buy a 900, and the first read for me, English is not my mother tongue, so it was a long read. I needed lots of time. And not all the chapters are easy to read. Of course, Tony usually is easy to read, and I can understand everything. But then we have other people, like, for example, Ashir,
yes.
who writes, I don't know, essays instead of chapters, like with a summary and a conclusion and everything. And he's very much on the spectrum, on the autistic spectrum. Do you say so?
Neurodivergent is the term.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. And I can't pronounce, but okay.
No, totally.
Did you do some research or do you happen to know people like Ash or?
Yeah.
Or you find it in yourself?
If you ask the people who know me, they're like, maybe Ash is the most like you, actually, out of all of these. Yeah, I mean, with Ash, I was always looking for sort of this way into, you know, I'm really interested by all these perspectives on the climate crisis, but I also wanted somebody who is just like as coldly logical as possible about the topic, probably because I sometimes am coldly logical about the topic. And once I started exploring Ash's perspective on things, this was a character who would change my mind about things I thought, if that makes any sense. Like having his voice in my ear was an exercise in like, well, you believe this, but interrogate that. Why? Like, what is it about? Or are these just like sort of biased beliefs that you've never really bothered to examine before about the situation, right? And so creating Ash was this enormous intellectual exercise. And actually, speaking of all those pages I cut, a lot of it was sort of Ash's pontificating about stuff because I just found it so interesting. You know, he's already a really long-winded character, but I think necessary too, because he sort of takes you through, here's the problem, here's what we have to do, here are the obstacles in the way, here's how we get around those obstacles. And, you know, like, but when he's talking about, you know, gambling on NBA basketball, and that chapter is like 50 pages long, then the author has to reflect to himself, maybe we don't need, you know, 25 of these pages on gambling about NBA basketball.
Yeah, maybe people won't buy a book that big. But, well, there are other thick books that get bought, so, well. Sure. I don't want to miss him. I really appreciated his view. He has some very intense chapters. Yeah. I really recommend to read that. It's highly interesting. And to be that logical about some stuff, sometimes it helps. If something is really bad and something really bad has happened, to have Ash there to think about it logically makes it easier to go further, I think.
Yeah, and I think what he does over the course of the book is sort of earn the reader's trust as the one person who is not going to let an unexamined bias get in his way, who is going to tackle every issue from like the most rational perspective. And trust me, that does not always mean the reader's going to find it palatable. That's part of his intensity is, you know, his ability to look at things from a cold, logical perspective is so all-consuming. But I also think his chapters are, you know, deeply emotional. Like, he does feel this incredible amount of love for the people close to him and is motivated to find a solution because of those people, because of the people he loves, as is every character in the book.
Yeah.
I often talk about how, like, we are not duty bound to solve the climate crisis because we're saving some abstract concept of ecology or our planetary systems. We're doing it for the people we care about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is why we're doing it. This is about as intimate an issue as exists. We are bound to do something about the climate crisis because of the love we have for each other, not because of some abstract concept about ecology.
And that's why this is the book about the climate change and climate catastrophe, at least of the decade, I think. I've read some others as well. Not all, of course, there are, I don't know, plenty. But because it's so near to the figures, I think it's really important. Plus, we cannot dive into it now, but you've already talked about in other interviews, you've done tons of research. Really tons of research. And I feel I know much more about the topic than I used to be. And I learned about it in a way that I can remember because I was emotionally involved. Absolutely. And I didn't just listen to Al Gore in a movie or something, which is also fine. But, you know, I wasn't that emotionally invested then. But reading The Deluge, I'm really invested.
Thank you. And yeah, that's obviously a goal of the novel is to make the crisis as urgent and personal as I feel it. It's so difficult with this topic because it feels so abstract. It feels so, you know, deep in the future or something that we can't really be bothered with in the course of our very complicated lives and our complicated world. And the book sort of frames it as like, no, this is everything, not just everything going on in the world. This is everything going on in your immediate life, within yourself. Like this is, you know, an issue that is going to reverberate for the rest of humanity. It attempts to pull the reader into that understanding.
And which is also important because sometimes in prose, you can feel the author and the author's opinion. And this might alienate some readers because they don't want to be converted or something. But this isn't the case here. Also, thanks to the different perspectives, we also have, you've already mentioned, the eco-terrorist, who is, of course, doing it differently from the scientists who are working for the government or the poor guy or the rich woman or, I don't know, or Kate Morris, who's an activist and not an eco-terrorist. So there are many opinions, and they are really different from each other. This is really good because it opens rooms. Think about where I am here. Where is my opinion? I am free because I don't feel your personal opinion.
Absolutely.
But I can find myself and take position somewhere in between the characters, not really near the eco-terrorist, maybe. But also to talk a little bit about her, she's also, which is really interesting and really brave, she's a mom who is alone with a kid. Yeah. And she tries to raise that kid, but also having this difficult task to manage. Well, I have two little kids. I'm not an eco-terrorist, but I have a husband. So it's much easier for me, but it's not easy. I have some kind of respect how she's pulling that through.
Yeah, I mean, to your first point, I was very careful to not give any character in the book my specific set of opinions to make sure that that this argument, this butting of heads was happening between the characters within every chapter. And I love that, like, a compliment I've gotten on the book before is people who tell me, I wasn't sure who was actually like the hero for a while. Like I wasn't sure where my allegiances lay in terms of what the characters thought. But yeah, with Shane, I was just committed to, again, like writing a real human being. And I thought about a lot about, you know, a working single mother who happens to have a side project that is bringing down the fossil fuel hierarchy. So, you know, giving her this challenge in her life that is, you know, both the sidecar project to what she has to do is raise this little girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, again, that helps frame all of these issues as human issues, as things that that people must deal with in addition to the intimacy of their lives.
Yeah. That really made her story for me very real. I could somehow identify my English is, it's evening for me.
This is great. My German is lacking. That's the problem.
Yeah. Apropos, your German is lacking. So there already was a translation to Italian and to French.
Yeah.
The Italian and the French guys now can read your book in their mother language. And we are very interested to have a German translation. I talked to some other climate fiction and science fiction fans, and some even have already bought the book and now are sitting before in front of the book, 900 pages in English. I'm not sure if I can handle this. Is there any, would you like to have the book translated in more languages in Europe or other countries? What are we hoping for now?
Yeah, of course. I mean, even though the book is obviously pretty deeply American, I do believe it comes with this, you know, this universal seed of the fact that we're all facing this issue together. And so getting it translated is obviously a top priority. And hopefully, you know, some of your listeners can perhaps help in that. Like, I do think my French publisher has been very intent on talking to some of his friends in the German publishing business and hopefully getting the book translated there. So, you know, it's always an uphill climb to get a 900-page book translated into a bunch of different languages. But, you know, it took me 12 years to write it. So I can keep working and I can keep pushing and hopefully we'll get there.
It won't outdate so easily, unfortunately.
Right.
And it will be 1,000 pages in German because we need so much space.
Yeah. That's right.
I've read quite a few things in German and English, and it's always thicker in German. I don't know why we need so many words to say something. Also, big words. Very interesting. And will there be a show?
That's another thing I'm working on. Over here in Hollywood, we're going through a bit of a rough patch. It's a little bit of a recession, you might call it. And so the appetite for a big, political, expensive series is not there right now. But I also... Look, I for everything in life, you have to have this little bit of tirelessness, you know, you have to be indefatigable. And when things don't work out, you figure out another angle and you try again. And obviously getting this book from an idea in my head to being fully written to published was the biggest hurdle of my life. And, you know, I'm you know, more or less grateful that I'm encountering these new hurdles now.
Yeah, because the book is already there. And I have already heard that you're working on new things, but shorter things.
Yeah. So my next book will be a collection of short stories. And then after that, I will return to another big epic novel.
Yeah, that's cool. So we have been very efficient because of your time. But if there is anything you would like to add to your, I guess, mostly German audience.
Yeah.
Now it's the time.
No, I mean, I would just love if folks in Germany picked up the book, if they have the necessary sort of English background to get through a really heavy scientific, political, dense, but page-turnery. We have to keep mentioning that. Page-turnery novel.
Sometimes it's even as if you would read a very, very suspenseful Hollywood movie, one of the good ones, and it's really, you can't put it down.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And the best part is, if we can get it published in Germany, then maybe I'll get invited over to do a little book tour and I can do some traveling. And yeah, exactly. That's all. That's the real goal. That's the real goal.
Yeah, look at all the cool cities here.
Exactly.
And the old buildings in the south.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Thanks a lot for joining me here. I still can't believe it. I just mailed you and you answered. So sometimes I'm just lucky.
It sounded like a good time, and it was.
Yes, that's cool. So thanks a lot, and I hope we will have a translation soon, and I would certainly dive into this short story collection as well.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.